Welcome to the Infrastructure Show. I'm your host, Professor Joseph Schoffer of Northwestern University. The Infrastructure Show is designed to present to listeners the reality of America's infrastructure, its condition, why it is the way it is, and what can be done about it. In this third of our three-part series of conversations about building with concrete, we'll focus on the construction process itself. Our guest is Paul James, who's Senior Vice President with Lend-Lease U.S. Construction Incorporated in Chicago, who's had many years of experience directing the construction of large buildings. Thanks for talking with us today. Can you give us a sense of why we're seeing the tallest buildings in the world being built out of concrete when I remember historically they were built out of steel?
Well, the choice of materials is specific to both location of the project and the use of the building. Traditionally, when the building has an office use or a retail use or a hospital use, one of the desires of the owner is to have flexibility for the use of the space. And steel structures are much easier to supplement for additional loading. If someone wanted to put a higher loading than the building was designed for in a particular area, you can plate the steel and make other arrangements. With a concrete structure, it's less common to do that. The other advantage to steel building is that it is traditionally able to be erected faster than a concrete building. The advantages to concrete, of course, are that the building is stiffer. So when we're building tall buildings that are primarily for residential or hospitality use, the user comfort is important. So concrete buildings tend to be stiffer, have less sway than a steel building, such as the Willis Tower in Chicago or the Hancock building.
So how high does a building have to be before sway as a function of wind velocity becomes an issue for the occupants?
Again, it depends upon the occupancy. In office uses, it comes up very little. Even in Sears Tower, which is a fairly flexible bundled tube and has quite a bit of sway, it's really not noticeable to the occupants because they're busy with their activities. But in a residential building, when you're trying to sleep or you're taking a nice hot bath to watch the water sway in your tub is a little disconcerting. What they try to do is to dampen the buildings on taller buildings, whether it be steel or concrete, through the use of dampers, either a water slosh damper or a mass tune damper, to try and control the sway at the top of buildings. They don't seem to be much of a factor on buildings that are 700 to 800 feet tall, but once you get over 800 feet, designers look at it to determine if they're required or not. On the Trump Tower, the developer, Donald Trump, did not want to use a mass tune damper, so the building is stiffer than it would have been had we used a mass tune damper, and he spent more money on the structure, but he did not spend money on the damper.
And that is a concrete building.
Trump Tower is a concrete building. The third type of construction we're seeing very common today, particularly for office buildings, is a concrete core, a steel floor frame building. It combines the rigidity of the concrete for the core element, and yet they still get the flexibility of the floors with the steel deck.
And in that core, that usually elevators there, utilities are in the core. Am I getting that right?
Traditionally, yes, and they'll usually put the stairs in the core.
And what fraction of the usable floor does that take up?
Depends upon the design of the building. So the taller the building, the more core that is required, typically to accommodate the fact that taller buildings will tend to have more elevators, they'll need to have larger air shafts. So it's a function of the design of the building. If you're in an office building which has a lot of elevators, the typical office building would have one elevator for about every 50,000 net rentable square feet. The space needed for elevators is quite extensive. In residential buildings, the density is less, so the number of elevators is less.
Is the number of elevators, as you describe it, the difference between a residential and an office building driven by the demand to move quickly between the floors, or is there some other factor?
It's primarily driven by to move quickly between floors and to accommodate the number of people in a building. An office building will typically have much denser usage.
Yeah.
In office buildings today, the office design is to put more people in the same amount of space. So the office density can be one person for every 100 to 150 square feet. In a residential building, the residents are often one or two people in units of any size, 1,000 feet, 2,000 feet. So the population density in office buildings is in the thousands, perhaps even at Sears Tower in the tens of thousands. And in a residential building that has 500 units, the density of residents might be 1,000 plus or minus people. So the number of users of the building is very different. And also in residential buildings, people tend to come in all times of the day. And in office buildings, there's obviously a rush in the morning, a rush in the evening, and a rush at lunchtime.
So you need to accommodate that with elevator capacity.
You need to accommodate that with elevator capacity.
So let me take you back to the construction process. What's the rate-limiting factor in building a tall building with concrete? My presumption is you can build a lot faster with steel.
Generally speaking, you can build faster in steel, but if you're doing a very tall building, the advantages to concrete, which provides also more sound deadening between the floors, so you hear less between the floors, and again, the stiffness of the building. In the very tall buildings, the limiting factor tends to be the size of the floor plate, so very narrow, thin buildings are more flexible, whether they're out of concrete or steel. So Trump has very large floor plates. It's a fairly stiff building. Other buildings that have smaller floor plates are, say, fairly flexible building because of its smaller floor plate, facade area ratio. So you can build buildings, to successfully build all concrete buildings to 1,500 feet or so, which is a little less than 300 meters.
How fast can you build that building? And I remember talking to somebody about the Sears Tower who said they built a floor a day. That's a steel building.
They did not build a floor a day. They built in office buildings, particularly for erecting the structure. In a steel building, we would refer to it as a tier. A tier is typically two office floors, and we would try and do a tier a week. So you build two floors a week. In a concrete building, it's driven by what you can get in your cycle on tall buildings. A very efficient cycle would be a three-day cycle, but on larger buildings and taller buildings, it could be a three-day, four-day, five-day, even a six-day cycle, so it would be slower. The other limiting factor on very tall buildings is the weather is different at 1,000 feet in the air than it is at the ground. The winds are stronger. You cannot operate your construction equipment, the cranes and the hoists, when the wind is over 30 miles an hour. And in Chicago, which has winters, actually icing up of equipment becomes a problem on cold winter days.
So there are days when you can't build.
There are more days that you can't build at 1,000 feet in the air than you would have closer to the ground.
How do the winds and particularly the low temperatures affect the rate of curing of concrete?
They have some effect on it, but we traditionally will be heating the concrete in the winter, so we're heating the underside of the concrete. And with our protection systems, we have the sides of the slabs that are being formed are enclosed to prevent material from falling out. So it provides an enclosure in which you can heat the underside of the slab and have it not affect the curing very much. It certainly does some. The top of the slabs risk being frozen, so you may have to put blankets over the top of the slab. Generally speaking, the setup, the finishing of the slabs is slower in the winter than it is in the summer, so it takes longer on the deck to get them finished.
But just to be clear, when you're building a concrete building and you pour the slab and the columns on a floor, how quickly can you come back and pour the next floor?
Well, once the floor starts to set up, once there's been enough finish on the floor to allow you to walk on it, you'll start standing your frames for the next floor. That's usually the next day after the slab pour.
So that's pretty quick, but I assume that you keep the supports in place as you go up till the floor below gains enough strength to stand on its own.
In concrete structures, you typically need to provide shoring and reshoring for the cure time for the slab, which is typically based on a 28-day strength. So you will have a couple of sets of forms on the active floors, the floors that you've actually framed, and then after you strip those floors or you recycle the forms, you will also have several floors of reshoring so that you're transferring the load to the floors below. That cycle of floors can be anywhere from 5 to 7 floors worth of both sets of forms and reshores.
Mm-hmm. And I assume that it's the design engineer who specifies the concrete properties as the person responsible for construction. Do you have a role in that?
Certainly, the design engineers will specify the mechanical properties they're looking for. What is the ultimate strength? What is the modulus of elasticity? What is the if they want to have special appearance, they want to use white cement, those kinds of elements that affect the structure. But these are descriptions that take advantage of ACI, the American Concrete Institute specifications, and the Portland Cement Association to tell the, typically in this case, the ready-mix supplier and the concrete contractor how the materials to operate once it's in place. But there is a lot of means and methods on how this is achieved. For instance, on the design mix, if the designer has specified a 12,000 PSI pounds per square inch strength at 56 days, then the ready-mix supplier will traditionally refer back to previous mixes that they've used that have achieved those results. Or if they have not, then they will produce a trial batch that'll be tested to see if they have the properties. Concrete today at high strength is more than the traditional sand, aggregate, and cement of the Roman times. There's a lot of chemical additives that are used to enhance the properties, to get the higher strength, to have less cracking, to do all the things that are required in our modern buildings today. So the mix designs have a number of elements in them that are specifically added to get the proper quality that's needed and yet to do it at the most economical price.
In the tallest buildings, and I particularly remember the Trump building in Chicago, the concrete was moved to the top of the building by pumping it, which seems to me requires a different rheology, a different viscosity. Who specifies that? Is that construction function or design function?
The designers care about two things. One is the slump as it comes out the pump. They don't want it to be too watery, so they'll specify what the slump or how viscous the concrete is as it comes out the pump. And they'll also allow the use of what are referred to as high-range water-reducing agents or plasticizers. The use of these chemical additives produce a concrete that is very viscous and more easily pumped. And as the concrete as it goes through the pipes that are being pumped to the top of the deck, that viscosity is a temporary condition, and it doesn't require additional water. In traditional concrete, if you wanted it to be a wetter mix, you added more water, but the current design is such that they want to limit the amount of water in the concrete, so they're using these chemical agents to induce a temporary high viscosity to allow it to be pumped. This, again, is a joint effort with the ready-mix supplier, with the concrete contractor knowing his equipment and how his pumps are going to work, and with the structural engineer to make sure that they are able to demonstrate that they can produce the properties that are required and still allow it to be placed.
Interestingly complicated, and then those of us that stand on the sidewalk and watch these buildings being built, I think, can sometimes think it's a simple process, but there's a lot of science and engineering that goes into it. Paul, I really appreciate your spending the time with us today to give us a bit of an education on building tall buildings, and I look forward to seeing buildings that you build in the future. Thank you.
Thank you.